Genesis chapter 6, 9 through chapter 9. We're going to look at the whole flood account as we're kind of trying to speed up as we walk through the Genesis account. And certainly the flood narrative as we walk through it forms, you know, one unit within this book. And, you know, as we continue to walk through this book, just keep reminding ourselves of the structure of it, how 6-9 starts off with, these are the generations of Noah. And of course, you know, as you continue to walk through this book, you get to chapter 10. Now, these are the records of the generations of Shem. And so you could see pretty clearly there that 6-9 through 9-28 forms one unit there. And certainly the flood narrative just has a great cohesion to it. It just, the story flows just kind of from scene to scene to scene to scene, just with one continuous flow there. So it is good to deal with the whole thing. And we started off last week by introducing the flood narrative in verse 9 through 22. And I encourage you all to kind of read through the narrative as well and just kind of look. And so I think maybe a good way to start off would just be to see, maybe just review what we, you know, how we introduced the flood narrative last week with 6, 9 through 22. And if you have any other comments as once again we dive in to 7 through 9. So I'll just open it up at that point and for observations or comments or questions before we start in.
Right. When we start in, we're going to still review 9 through 22?
Sure. Yes. Now, any observations? What jumps out at you as you study through this section? What seems to be maybe repeated themes or emphases?
Families, like different lines.
Sure, different lines. Good. And when we started way back at the beginning of Genesis, the seed of the woman, the seed of the serpent, just these lines, these genealogies that continue to work themselves through the book. Certainly we see that continuing through here. And as we get to the end of it, we'll see some of those lines and how they're fleshed out. So we'll continue to trace this idea of the seed of the woman, the seed of the serpent as we walk through this book. Good. So that's certainly something we see here. Anything else? What was some of the things that were striking about even the section we looked at from chapter 6 last week? Just things that were maybe repeated that we saw from earlier in the book of Genesis, ties back, ties forward.
I don't remember if it was mentioned last week, but Earth. I mean, I have ESV, but the word Earth just keeps getting repeated. I mean, verse 11, 4, Earth was corrupt, Earth was filled with violence, God saw the Earth, they had corrupted their way on the Earth, and then God says He'll destroy them with the Earth in 13.
Good. Absolutely. So once again, a lot of different things that kind of come into play with just the two Hebrew words for earth and land. One is, it just continues to remind us that God is a global God, that God's purposes are global. God deals with the whole earth. His plan is for the whole earth. And so those are some of the themes that you're mentioning there. But also just as the word land continues to run through the book as well, it's a reminder that the land of Israel is God's land. He's in control over the land. He's sovereign over the land. And so those two themes kind of go together. But certainly as the Israelites are about to go into the promised land, just all these continued emphases of the land just remind them that God's the one that's doing things with the land. God's in control over the land. And so I think those are good emphases that you're seeing there, Kyle. So good.
Okay, just double-clicking on Earth. Like, it's 17 times in chapter 1 and up to 2-4 of Genesis, Earth occurs, and then it's not until chapter 4 and it's twice, and then in chapter 6 it's 6-4, 6-5, 6-6, 6-11, 6-12, 6-13, 6-17, and most of these are God is sorry that He made man in the earth. What was the point of this?
Well, I mean, certainly just the global emphasis, and there, it's good that you bring that up. As we read through this narrative, we're going to see a lot of ties back to the first few chapters of Genesis, to the point that I would go so far as that the narrator, Moses, is seeking to draw a connection there and to cause our minds to see that this is really almost a recreation. That seems to be kind of the emphasis, that Noah is like a second Adam, and so God is going to start over with the earth. And even, you know, we'll see as we come later, God gives the same command to Noah that he gave to Adam, be fruitful and multiply. You know, that should kind of ring a bell in your ears. And you know, we'll see that Noah was naked, and that should ring a bell from earlier as well in the narrative where Adam and Eve were naked. So we'll tie some of those things together. But I think one of the themes that runs throughout here is God is starting over with the earth. God is recreating the earth. But what's beautiful about that theme is if you tie it in with the greater purpose of the book, is that, you know, the theme of this book is God's plan for the world. God's plan to bless the world through the descendant of Abraham, as we see in chapter 12 as we're walking there. What we're going to see is even though the earth had gotten to such a corrupt state, as we see here in chapter 6, God's plan didn't fail. And so the whole world was corrupt, and yet God preserved that seed of the woman. God preserved that line, and he started over and still kept that intact. And so it just, once again, God is, so much the theme here is God is able to bring about his purposes, even despite the greatest of human sin and the greatest wickedness. And we certainly saw a lot of that last week as we looked through chapter 6. So I would say it just continues to emphasize God's global nature, God's global purposes. That, I mean, certainly this is a worldwide flood. And so that emphasizes to me, as I look at it, that God's plan involves the whole world. And God is not just a local God. And that's certainly one of the things that the Israelites needed to hear as well as they're going into the promised land. Their God is not like the other gods of the nations. You know, the other gods of the nations, you know, have limited power and limited authority and limited domain. But God is not like that. He's a global God. He's the God of the universe. He's the God over all the earth. He's the God that wiped out the entire earth, you know, in the days of Noah. And those are important things for the Israelites to remember as they're going into the promised land, that their God is not like the gods of the nations. And it's important for us to remember as well, right? That our God is a global God. He has a plan for the whole world. And so those are important emphases that we see here.
You know what the Dalai Lama said this week? He was in Seattle. He said, "You shouldn't be a Buddhist. You shouldn't be a Buddhist. Americans shouldn't be Tibetan Buddhists because they should stick with their cultural traditions that are more familiar to them." That was interesting. Well, you must not believe that this God is very global.
Yeah. Well, in the case of Buddhism, they don't really... Yeah, anyway. I mean, yeah, it's...
Not the same kind of God.
Right, absolutely. And that's a great point, you know, that it's localized. It's not a global... God wants global worship. And we'll see that as we continue to walk through the Old Testament. I mean, in Zechariah, going through that book in at EBC, and you just see God's global nature come out once again. It's all established back here. So that's good. Anything else? Just as you read through this flood narrative, phrases that are repeated, emphases... All right, we'll walk in here and we'll pull some of these things out. So feel free to stop me if you have other observations or questions. So let's just start by, let me read just as a review what we did last week, and we'll just quickly touch on it before we jump into chapter 7. These are the records of the generations of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his time. Noah walked with God. Noah became the father of three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now the earth was corrupt in the sight of God, and the earth was filled with violence. God looked on the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way upon the earth. Then God said to Noah, "The end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence because of them, and behold, I am about to destroy them with the earth. Make for yourself an ark of gopher wood. You shall make the ark with rooms, you shall cover it inside and out with pitch. This is how you shall make it. The length of the ark 300 cubits, and its breadth 50 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. You shall make a window for the ark, and finish it to a cubit from the top, and set the door of the ark in the side of it. You shall make it with lower, second, and third decks. Behold, I, even I, am bringing the flood of water upon the earth to destroy all flesh in which is the breath of life from under heaven. Everything that is on the earth shall perish. But I will establish my covenant with you. And you shall enter the ark, you and your sons and your wife and your sons' wives with you. And of every living thing of all flesh, you shall bring two of every kind into the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female. of the birds after their kind, the animals after their kind, of every creeping thing which is on the ground after its kind, two of every kind will come to you to keep them alive. As for you, take for yourself some of all food which is edible, and gather it to yourself, and it shall be for food for you and for them. Thus Noah did according to all that God had commanded him, so he did. So we start off with, obviously, with the background to the flood. We talked about it last week, so I'm not going to go into too much detail. But the emphasis is on that word corrupt, which is repeated many times in this chapter. You saw many times it says, you know, God, behold, God looked on the earth and it was corrupt. You know, that earlier it says the earth was corrupt and they had corrupted their way, just on and on, corrupt. And then we said that that's the same word for destroy. And so they were corrupt, so God was going to destroy them. And just the contrast of the wicked and corrupt world with Noah. And just, he was a righteous man, blameless in his time, and how he walked with God. And obviously so much of the emphasis, you read through the bulk of the flood narrative, and you see the emphasis isn't so much on the wickedness of the people. I mean, that's there, and you see it certainly here in chapter 6, but the emphasis is on Noah. And the emphasis is on Noah's righteousness, and on Noah's faithfulness, and certainly on Noah's obedience, on Noah's faith. It's just striking. When we went through Hebrews, Noah always jumps out at me, because you just think about the situation he was in, right? It never rained on the earth, and God says, build this gigantic boat, you know? And it probably took him 100 years. Who knows how long it took him? It took years and years with him and his sons, just like building this massive boat, and just the faith that that would have taken. But it was a trust in God, a belief in God. Certainly, I think, with the emphasis on faith throughout the book of Genesis, you know, just how even Abraham believed God and it was credited to him as righteousness, as we'll get there in chapter 15. Noah's an example of faith. And he's an example of obedient faith. Faith, as James says, that works. Faith that is not dead, because he acted on what he did. And just the emphasis in here, as you get to verse 22, thus Noah did according to all that God commanded him, so he did. And that little refrain runs throughout this flood narrative. Over and over again, Noah did according to everything that God commanded him. And the message is real straightforward. It's God calls for obedience. God calls for obedience, for faith and trust in him that is willing to hear his word and just believe it and do it. And it's a simple message, but a message that we really need to hear. Just continue. And even where it talks about, you know, all the description of the ark, I think when it goes through and describes the ark, it's not so much so that we could draw a picture of the ark in our Sunday school books, so much as it is to show the detail that Noah went to in fulfilling God's command. It's emphasizing, you know, Noah did it exactly like God said. Yeah.
It's kind of like a little observation. What I kind of like about it is kind of like, he didn't like partially follow him, he followed him like completely.
Absolutely.
Like, and it's kind of hard because I know like other people like can't follow him completely. So that's what I kind of like about that.
No, absolutely. That's a huge emphasis, you know, and that's where it says, according to all that God commanded him, right? And that's what you're emphasizing. And that's such an important point, that God calls for complete obedience. And obviously this obedience was one that had to flow out of faith, because you don't just build a boat in the middle of dry land unless you believe that God's going to do what he said. And so such a huge emphasis on this is on Noah's obedience, his walking with God, his righteousness, his trust in God, all those themes that the Israelites needed as well. They needed to have that complete and total loyalty to God in obedience to him if they were going to accomplish his purpose for them. And that's one of the main themes that runs throughout the Pentateuch, is God wants his nation to be this exalted nation that's a light to the world, that shines to the Gentiles and all these things, but it can only happen when they're obedient. That's what the message of Zechariah is. You know, this can only happen when you're holy. It can only happen when you're obedient, when you're walking in right relationship with God. And so that's why Noah's emphasized and not the wicked. Certainly the wicked, you know, are judged for their corruption and for just even the heinous things that we read about with the sons of God and the daughters of men and just the complete wickedness. But the emphasis in this story is on obedience. It's on faith. It's on trust. And therefore, just the exhortation to us is to live like Noah, to walk and to trust and to obey like he did. And to realize that there's this, it's interesting because we talked about as well that covenant comes up for the first time in this section of Scripture. And it's just the reminder that covenant is this relationship where you enter into relationship with God, where you commit to be faithful to Him and He commits to be faithful to you. And in this flood narrative, that's in one sense somewhat of what is played out here is, you know, is Noah going to be faithful? You know, God has this plan, but is Noah going to fulfill, in one sense, his side of the bargain? Because think about what would have happened if Noah disobeyed, right? I know we're thinking, we understand so clearly the sovereignty of God that sometimes we forget the human responsibility side of it. But just as a hypothetical, I know it couldn't have happened, but just imagine for a second what would have happened if Noah disobeyed. He didn't build the ark, right? I mean, God's whole plan for the world, in one sense, is shot. Now, I mean, obviously it's a horrible hypothetical because God is not going to allow that to happen. But I think for myself, it just stresses the importance of how God uses us and how God wants us to be faithful so He can accomplish His purpose. And then on the other side, you could flip it as well and think about Noah, right? Trusting in God's faithfulness, right? What if, you know, the boat didn't, you know, wasn't seaworthy? Or what if, I mean, go on and on and on, you know, what if the floodwaters came and they never went down? I mean, you could just come up with all these hypotheticals. Noah was dependent on God's faithfulness as well. And so they both, in one sense, kind of the, I won't say the tension, but some of the story here is both of them having to rely, because of this covenant relationship, on the other's faithfulness. And that's so much of a theme that runs throughout Scripture. It's just, we can depend on God, and He calls us to trust in Him. And so we'll see how that's fleshed out through this narrative.
It seems strange that God doesn't say He'll do anything. Like He says, I'll establish my covenant with you, and you'll do all these things.
Yeah, later I think it talks about, oh man.
The next time it says is in Genesis 9 when He said,
right,
I establish my covenant, like same language, and then...
Which verse is the first one is 6:18.
And then 9:9 is the next one.
Yeah, I think it's kind of implied, I guess. I mean, and you shall enter the ark. I mean, and it's kind of like ... He doesn't necessarily say what...
That's the promise, you can.
Right, but I mean, it's kind of implied that you're going to enter the ark and be saved. I think that's kind of implied there.
Especially because He mentions He's going to destroy everyone else.
Right, exactly. So just in the context, I would say that God's side of the bargain is saving Noah. And so just the reminder, just like Enoch, right? Enoch walked with God, and so God spared him from death. Noah walks with God, and he's spared from the flood. And so it's just that call to relationship with God. All right, anything else then about chapter 6? Just as we review before we dive into 7 through 9. Yeah.
This is kind of talked about already, maybe, I don't know, but talking about the earth in chapter 6 and how John mentioned that's like the first time it's mentioned so much since chapters 1 and 2. And just the emphasis that we talked about in 1 and 2 on the earth being so good and the emphasis in chapter 6 on it being so bad, which is a really sharp contrast.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you do, and as we've said, really in chapters 1 through 11, what we're tracing is the downfall and the results of sin, and therefore the need for God to establish His plan to restore goodness and blessing to the world, which He's going to do through the seed of Abraham. And so, good, that's a great observation. We just continue to see it go downhill. It's not going to get any better. Right after this is the Tower of Babel. And so, you know, once again, we see the earth continuing to go downhill and opposed to God and His plan. And finally, then in chapter 11, we hit the high point. Chapter 12 with Abraham, we see God's plan to restore that blessing to the world. And so, just the more I study it, it just does give it that global perspective. Good, good option.
With the good thing, good is used up till the middle of chapter 3, and then it's like knowing good and evil, and then it's not mentioned until after the Abrahamic covenant is in chapter 15, after chapter 3.
It's good.
It's kind of an obvious point, but Noah was the only righteous person around. The reason I say that is because in Sodom, Lot said, oh God, if there are 50 people. There are 40 people. If there are, would it get him to 10 or 5 people? 10 people, right? If there are 10 righteous people, and God said, I will not destroy Sodom for 10 righteous people. Like, it's literally meaning that no, the only righteous person around. Like, it really means that.
Yeah,
it's just another, it's another good reminder, you know, I think. Even if you're the only righteous person, you should still do what God says. Because there's big consequences for those who don't. Even if it takes 100 years for those consequences to come about. Like, you still be faithful regardless, no matter what.
Absolutely. Great point.
I mean, it's, I guess it's the most obvious point, but it's really helpful to remember.
It's good. That's good. And so as we come into chapter 7 through 9, you kind of have a whirling array of activity here, and it really shows just God's judgment on the earth, just in all the activity, the flurry of activity that's going to happen here, just the wrath of God on sin. You see, it's interesting too, and I didn't trace this very carefully, but one of the commentators was making the point that it's kind of interesting the perspective, like kind of think of it like a movie. You know, where's the camera? You know, as this story goes through, and it starts off like you're kind of looking from above, from God's perspective, but then when the flood comes, it's like you're kind of going down to the earth's perspective, and you lose God's perspective, and you're kind of forced to like almost like be on the level of Noah, like, am I going to get in the ark with Noah or not? Or like, you're kind of feel like when the flood waters are there, it's like, oh, I'm in the boat with Noah. Am I going to trust in God? And just kind of forces you to kind of put yourself almost in his shoes or in the shoes of the people around. And you don't so much have God's perspective, and just, you can't, in one sense, when you read this narrative, you can't just sit and look down in judgment on everyone else, because the narrator puts your perspective kind of at everyone else's level. And that's kind of an interesting thought. I'd like to, you know, check that out some more, but we could watch for that as we walk through here. And so, as we said, one of the main emphases just on Noah's obedience, and obviously the faith that took, the meticulous care that he took to obey. And so that jumps us into chapter 7. So let's begin. Then Yahweh said to Noah, "Enter the ark, you and all your household, for you alone I have seen to be righteous before me in this generation. You shall take with you of every clean animal by sevens, a male and his female, and of the animals that are not clean too, a male and his female. Also of the birds of the sky by sevens, male and female, to keep offspring alive on the face of all the earth." And that word for offspring, if I'm not mistaken, is the word for seed. The word that, you know, goes all the way back to God is preserving his seed. God is preserving the righteous line. It brings you right back to, you know, the first few chapters of Genesis. Genesis chapter 3 and the promise there. Sorry, I lost my place. Where am I? For after 7 more days, I will send rain on the earth 40 days and 40 nights, and I will blot out from the face of the land everything that I have made. Notice this refrain once again. Noah did according to all that Yahweh had commanded him. Now Noah was 600 years old when the flood of water came upon the earth. Then Noah and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him entered the ark because of the water of the flood. Of clean animals and animals that are not clean and birds and everything that creeps on the ground, they went into the ark to Noah by twos, male and female, as God had commanded him. It came about it that after the 7 days, the water of the flood came upon the earth. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on the same day, all the fountains of the great deep burst open, and the floodgates of the sky were opened. The rain fell upon the earth for 40 days and 40 nights. So there we go. We start into this section, this story of the flood. And once again, just the repeats in 7:1 that Noah is righteous in this generation. Just that he's the only one that was in right relationship with God. He's the only one, just in contrast to all those around him. Now, it's interesting, too, here, even the distinction between the clean and the unclean animals. Probably they're somewhat, you know, for these Israelites, reminiscent of the distinction that God made, obviously, with the sacrifices and the clean and unclean animals there, and everything that they have in Leviticus about the ceremonial cleanliness. And it kind of reminds them that God's laws are not, how should I say this, but just willy-nilly. It has a foundation that goes all the way back you know, to the flood. It wasn't something that was kind of like made up at the time. It has a basis in creation. One of the when I was reading on the Pentateuch, one of the commentators said it really shows that God's law really fits in God's creation, you know. And so it's just a reminder that this goes all the way back. It's kind of giving in one sense a basis for the nation of Israel and their laws. You know, it has a basis. It wasn't just kind of made up on the spot. And so just kind of ties some of those things back there. And so once again, after 7 more days, in verse 4, I'll blot out from the face of the land every living thing that I have made. And so just the contrast here between, just like there's a distinction between the clean and unclean animals, there's a distinction between Noah and all those around him. And just as you read through this first section here, as you're preparing to walk into the flood, just once again in verse 9, as God had commanded Noah, just emphasize once again his complete obedience as he's about to walk into the ark. And then as you get to the fateful verse in verse 11, in the 600th year of Noah's life, just goes through all the details. Like, this is when the flood happened. Just to emphasize, in one sense, its historicity, that this actually happened. To emphasize, just that was a fateful day in the day of Earth's history, right? It was an important day. On that very day, you know, this massive cataclysm came. And even then, when it talks about how God wiped off everything from the face of the earth and just how he did it with water, it almost has the implication that God was cleansing his earth. God was just cleansing it. It had become so wicked that he sends this deluge, this flood upon the earth, just to wipe it completely clean. Let's start over. Let's start with a clean slate, as it were. And so Noah, this righteous man, because of his complete obedience and faith and trust in God, goes into the ark, trusting in God, and God, in one sense, trusting in him that he'd be obedient. And they go in with his family to be saved in this ark. Okay? All right. Anything else before we keep moving on?
Why the difference? I mean, I have the ESV, so I don't know what you have, but earth, ground, what? Different emphases, or?
Yeah, it's tough because there's two Hebrew words. There's adama, which is typically land, and there's eretz, which is typically earth, but both of them could almost be translated the other way too. And so certainly I would tend to see eretz as more focusing on the global nature, land. But see, there's a lot of word plays and things going on here as well, because the word for land is the same word for man. And so there, I'd have to look at each specific one, but sometimes there's word plays where like man is swiped off the land. And so it kind of, there could be a word play there, something like that. So there are different associations that those two words have. But I'd have to answer them on a more individualistic basis.
What verses are they?
Yeah. 17. Two. 2 and 17, and then you have,
well,
again, ESV, ground, and
20,
that's probably...
That's land, the Adamah, well, yeah.
And then, and 7, you have 3, 4, earth and 4, and then ground, and then 6, 8, 10, 12, 14.
Yeah.
You see 2...
ESV tends to, I mean, sorry, I have NASB, and NASB tries to keep it consistent, and so they try to translate Eretz, earth, all the time, and Adama, land, all the time, so you could see the distinction. And so in verse 3, you have to keep offspring alive on the face of all the earth, so that's a very global emphasis. And you go into verse 4, I'll blot everything from the face of the land. There, that's the other word. And so... I wouldn't necessarily see too much of a distinction there. I don't think he's making a huge theological point, but he is tying things back to the land that he had made, you know, all the way going back to Genesis, the sea and the dry land. I mean, you have all those different connections that kind of tie this whole thing together. Okay, so did someone else, I thought.
It makes, I mean, with at least 4 and 20 for land, it seems to be like physically like dirt kind of stuff as compared to like the world.
Mm-hmm.
Because, well, in 4, I'll blot out from the face of the land every living thing that I made, but we're assuming all the Loch Ness monsters still live, because why would the flood hurt them even?
Right, yeah, I mean, certainly throughout this, it talks about, oh, is this the verse? Just a second. In 7:4, when it says everything, it's an interesting word there, and I might even translate it everything which stands. It's a very rare word. And so it talks about everything that has the breath of life in it. And so certainly it's pretty clear as you walk through this narrative that it's only things that breathe that are going to die. I mean, and so certainly some fish probably died in this cataclysmic flood, but in general, the fish weren't wiped out. You know, it's only, I mean, we're going to, as we walk through this, we find out that this flood lasted for over a year. And so nothing can swim that long. That's not a fish, right? I mean, besides whales, anything else that breathes air is going to die. Because you just can't, I mean, crocodile, right? They swim, but they can't swim that long. That's why I think this word is thrown here, everything which stands. Like, if you have legs, it's because you walk on the ground. You're not, you know, and so everything that has legs is going to die, whether that be whatever.
And probably the same thing for birds.
Yeah, birds as well, absolutely. I mean, a bird can fly, but a bird can't fly that long, right? You know, a year of flying is, it can't do it. So that's why the birds have to come in, the creeping things, all the land animals, pretty much everything with legs. And it's a tough word because it's so rare, but I would, when it says every living thing, I would probably translate everything which stands. It's just appropriate to this context that he would pick a word that really distinguishes all life except for like this fish and the sea creatures. But once again, just emphasizing the global nature of this, but at the same time, emphasizing God's preservation of life, to keep them alive, right? That God's plan is not over, that it's still about life. It's about blessing. Despite this wickedness and catastrophe, God's plan to bless the world is not abrogated. It's still intact. And so it's a great, great truth.
It's interesting that it says in verse 10 that it came about after 7 days. It's kind of like they went in the ark got closed, and they were in the ark with lots of animals for 7 days, and there was no rain.
Yeah.
Like, what would you do if you're in the ark and you're arcing around with animals, and then it's like 5 days, and there's still nothing, and you're still in there, and then all of a sudden it starts to rain. Like one day, a certain day.
No, it's good. And I'm glad you brought that out because I didn't write it down, but there is a symmetry in the way that the flood progresses. As we get to chapter 8, we'll find that chapter 8 is the pivot point, 8:1. And it says God remembered Noah. And we'll talk about that in depth. But it's interesting because you have a build up to that point and a build down after it to where you have 7 days at the beginning of waiting, 7 days at the end. Actually, you have 2 sets of 7. Anyway, it's interesting because there's a lot of waiting, and we'll see that more strongly emphasized as they're waiting for the floodwaters to decrease. But I think the point you're making is that Noah waited on God, and in so doing, it shows Noah's trust in God, his faith in God. And that's a huge emphasis, especially as we get to the flood subsiding. It's like constantly emphasizing how long Noah's waiting. And it's just a reminder that, you know, we need to wait on God. We need to trust in God. He's going to bring about his word and his covenant. He's going to keep his side of the bargain. And so that's a good emphasis that you're bringing out there. Just the need for Noah to wait and trust. So that's a great emphasis.
It's interesting, too, that, like, people, when the floodwaters got to be so bad that they would start to try and climb the mountains or do whatever they would try to do, like, they would probably be beaten on the ark to get in. He would have to not open the door, not believe that there was anything else that... Because God didn't tell him to do anything else. He just told him to go in the ark and wait around for a week. He didn't even tell him to wait. He just said, just go, and then I'm going to bring flood. I just think it's interesting that...
Absolutely.
Those 7 days, what it would have been like to say, okay, it's really going to happen. We're in, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so, I mean, we're just... As we come into this next section... We're going to kind of read of, if you will, of the terrible disaster and destruction of the flood. And so it's just a reminder as all the preparation that God made for the ark and preserving life, or just kind of the first part of this brings all the details in of just all that God did to preserve life. And just in, you kind of have this contrast of God's terrible destruction, but also God's grace and his salvation. And so his salvation takes on new light when compared to his wrath and destruction. And so you see just his careful care for these people and for preserving his plan and for saving them.
Do you have any thoughts on how come his whole family got to get saved?
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily say that they were righteous, obviously. But yeah, that's a good question. I would tend to think that they probably, to some degree, were. The emphasis is certainly just on Noah. But as it has a lot to do with just the patriarchal, you know, he's the head of his household. And so therefore, if he's righteous, it kind of, his whole household is somewhat involved there. It's just a much more patriarchal family society that we're much more individualistic in our thinking. But even through this emphasis, it's interesting because it's everything is Noah, but it's Noah and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives. But they're like always kind of like tagged onto there, but it's all because of Noah. And so, I mean, some of the implications, I don't want to go, you could kind of go one of two ways with that. And I just want to be careful. Like on the one hand, you could say, well, they weren't righteous, but there's a teaching here that, you know, just the blessing of being, you know, the righteous man and his effects on his family and those kinds of things. And there may be some truth to that, but I don't want to push that. But what's that? Right. And so you could be pushed too far on the one hand. And then on the other hand, you could push, well, that they were righteous, but it doesn't really say that. So I don't want to stress either side too strongly there. I tend to think that they probably were righteous to some degree. And therefore
that was on a test anyway for Job. Anyway, that was a part of the whole process why they were all destroyed. I mean, it was a main test just for Job. It wasn't really necessarily as far as the story's played out, you know, it's more besides on Job going through this trial, and that's a result of it. That it wasn't necessarily that his family wasn't righteous; just that was a part of God testing them to have that happen to him.
And so, because maybe that example then isn't valid to say that so maybe it's not just blessing on his kids.
Yeah. Well, I mean, who was the guy who hid the stones in the tent? Joshua.
Oh yeah, Achan.
I mean, his whole family got killed because of his unrighteousness, because he's the head of the household. So I don't know if that's maybe a...
Right, and that's what I'm saying. And that section in Joshua there, Joshua 7, I mean, that's I've taught that passage kind of indirectly, but there's a huge emphasis on what I would theologically call solidarity, mm-hmm. which has the unity of a family and even of the nation. And that's why I say we tend to think just much more individualistically than the Bible did. And speaks and thinks. And so I don't want to overstress that. But at the same time, there probably is some degree of that where it's all about Noah here. And his family is kind of included within that.
The sons obviously helped build the ark. So there was some obedience involved anyway.
Yeah. And people go crazy because Ham, of course, sins later. And so it's like, how come God saved Ham and all that? But he just...
It's like, see, he just had it over with.
Yeah.
Just didn't bring Ham.
Yeah. Say they helped with that?
Well,
it doesn't. It's an implication.
Yeah, implication of just the massive size of the thing.
Since we're going to enter in the flood, I'd just like to make one small comment. I'm kind of sick of paintings, I hate to say this, like in nurseries with like these little happy animals, little birds chirping and stuff, and they're supposed to be like dark black thunder and like people dead in the water and like all these awful terrible things. Like maybe when it's after when the floodwaters have abated, they're all happy. But my wife and I, one time, we were in a nursery, we looked around and we're like, that is not what we were studying this. That is not what happened during the
because this is judgment.
Right, this is awful, terrible.
Narrow salvation.
Like, wiping out all breath. All that has the breath of life. It's awful. We make it a cartoon.
Like, isn't, like, those pictures like after the flood? Because don't you see the rainbow and everything?
Right, yeah. And that's why I was saying, like, yeah, maybe after.
I've seen it though where the boat, yeah, they're on the boat.
There's like rain.
All right, bring it back. But that's a great introduction here, because that's the emphasis. All right, as we do dive in here, this is the description of the judgment, and so we pick up where we leave off in verse 12, verse 13. On the very same day, Noah and Shem and Ham and Japheth, the sons of Noah, and Noah's wife and the three wives of his sons with him, entered the ark. They and every beast after its kind, and all the cattle after their kind, and every creeping thing that it creeps on the earth after its kind, and every bird after its kind, all sorts of birds. So they went into the ark to Noah, by twos of all flesh in which was the breath of life. Those that entered, male and female of all flesh, entered as God had commanded him, and the Lord closed it behind him. So once again, there's this refrain, everything according to what he did, everything according to what God had commanded him, and God sovereignly closed the door. And so then verse 17 here is where the flood comes upon the earth. Then the flood came upon the earth for 40 days. And the water increased and lifted up the earth so that it rose above the earth. The water prevailed and increased greatly upon the earth, and the ark floated on the surface of the water. The water prevailed more and more upon the earth so that all the high mountains everywhere under the heavens were covered. The water prevailed 15 cubits higher, and the mountains were covered. All flesh that moved on the earth perished. Birds and cattle and beasts and every swarming thing that swarms upon the earth and all mankind. Of all that was on the dry land, all in whose nostrils was the breath of the spirit of life died. Thus he blotted out every living thing that was upon the face of the land. From man to animals to creeping things and to birds of the sky, they were blotted out from the earth. And only Noah was left, together with those that were with him in the ark. The water prevailed upon the earth 150 days. You just read that, and it's just, it's your comment, right? It's a massive destruction of the whole earth. Now, anyone notice a word that's repeated throughout there? Prevailed. Absolutely. And the word prevailed there doesn't really do it justice. It's the same word that the Hebrew word warrior comes from. It's the idea that God conquered the earth. And so it's somewhat of a graphic. I mean, not in terms of like gory details, but it's this graphic picture of God conquering the earth in his sovereign wrath and justice and destruction. And so you can't read through this section without just a sense of awe of God's judgment on sinners. You just can't come away from it without that. Just the emphasis in this section is everything died. It's global, just complete destruction. God overpowered. How many times do I have here? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 8 times overpower. Just God prevailed. God won the battle. God was victorious. He overpowered. That's probably how I would translate. He overpowered everyone. Just God's omnipotent power came in judgment, and he overpowered them like a warrior. And so you come away from this and just sense of awe. Wow. Just all life, everything that, and doesn't leave any room for any exceptions, does it? I mean, you can't read through this and think, well, maybe some people escaped. It doesn't leave any room for that. And so certainly just the awesome, terrifying nature of God's judgment. I mean, a flood sounds so nice compared to, like, you know, how the earth is going to be judged with fire in the future, but there's nothing really nice about this judgment, in that sense. And so, it's God's awesome wrath against sin. And of course, the backdrop to that is just God's grace and mercy and salvation. He saved Noah because he was righteous, because he trusted, because he walked in faith. Great section just to remind us of the awesome, well, the heinousness of sin, to emphasize the need for trusting in God. And yeah. Any other comments or observations? Very sobering. I mean, it's the whole world. I mean, we don't know how big it was at that time, but millions of people probably. I mean, we have no idea. It could have been The population could have been the population like today. Who knows? They lived almost 1,000 years, you know, at that time. And so it's just sobering. All right. And then we come to verse chapter 8. But God remembered Noah. That's as I said, that's the hinge of this whole section. It's not that God forgot, obviously. Oh, what happened? Where's Noah? What's he doing? You know? No, it's just a reminder that God, the idea of remembering is that God once again acted faithful to his word. Right? He acted in line with the promise that he had made to him. In one sense, he remembered the promise, and so he acted in line with it. And so it's just God will remember his word. He will be faithful to his promises. And so, therefore, we could trust in him. We could depend upon him. He will be faithful. And so this ties in so clearly with the covenant, right? If God is faithful, if God remembers his word, then you could trust in God, right? And that's once again, everything I'm relating back to Zechariah, but Zechariah means Yahweh remembers. That's what his name means. And that's probably the main theme of the book. Because God will be faithful. He will keep his word. It may not look like it. You know, it may seem like you're in the ark for a long time, but God isn't going to forget. And that's what this great reminder is. And so therefore, we could trust in him. And so he caused a wind to pass over the earth and the waters subsided. So we'll just continue on here. And also the fountains of the deep and the floodgates of the sky were closed and the rain from the sky was restrained and the waters receded steadily from the earth. And at the end of 150 days, the waters decreased. In the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, the ark rested upon the mountains of Ararat. The waters decreased steadily until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the first day of the month, the tops of the mountains became visible. Then it came about the end of 40 days that Noah opened the window of the ark which he had made, and he sent out a raven, and it flew here and there until the water was dried up from the earth. Then he sent out a dove from him to see if the water was abated from the face of the land. But the dove found no resting place for the sole of her foot, so she returned to the ark, for the water was on the surface of all the earth. And then he put out his hand and took her and brought her into the ark to himself. So he waited yet again 7 days, and he again sent out the dove from the ark. And the dove came to him toward evening, and behold, in her beak was a freshly picked olive leaf. So Noah knew that the water was abated from the earth. And then he waited yet another 7 days and sent out the dove, but she did not return to him again. Now it came about in the 601st year, in the first month, on the first of the month, the water was dried up from the earth. Then Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked, and behold, the surface of the ground was dried up. In the seventh month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth was dry. And just in that section, there's a lot of details about how, you know, the waters are drying up, and he sends out the raven, he sends out the dove a couple times, and I think the purpose of this is the story kind of slows down here to cause you to kind of feel the waiting. You know, several times in here it says that he waited, right? Noah was waiting. And so just, you know, he was in that ark for a year and just took a long time for God to remember, but he just had to patiently wait and trust on God. And so the application there, once again, right? We have to wait on God. You know, it's his timing. It's his plan, you know? And so, you know, he had to wait. And there's all these references to time in this section, right? He had to wait a week, and then he sent out another. He had to wait 40 days for this. He had to wait 150 days for this. And there's all these references to time. And so it's just a reminder that sometimes you got to wait on God, you know. But you, in that process of waiting, you got to keep trusting, because you know he won't forget you. You know he won't forget his promises. You know that he will be faithful to his word. And so therefore, we can depend upon him and trust in him. So I think that's the main emphasis of that section. You know, just all these stories about all that's going on here is just to continually emphasize that point, that he had to wait for this, then he had to wait for this, then he had to wait for this, then he had to wait for this. And it's a long time of waiting. But once again, God is faithful through it all. And so you come to the end of it, the earth is dried up, and God brought him through this flood. He entered, you know, it is kind of just a picture that God had recreated the earth. Right, it's a fresh beginning. You know, he kind of entered into the ark. It's almost like a time warp or something, like a wormhole. It's like you go into this ark. You know, the world was, you know, everything that you had known for however many hundreds of years. You walk out, and the earth is just completely different. It's kind of a radical thought, but just God, in saving him, brought about his plan once again for the earth. And so Noah is going to come out of the ark.
It's interesting that God gave him something to do while he was there. Like, it says that he's supposed to bring food for all the animals in there. So it's not like God wanted to sit there for a year and do nothing. Because I was wondering, well, what kind of conversation would you have for a year and 4 months or whatever? What would you talk about or do, you know? You're still faithful to God because you're in the ark there, but what do you do in the meantime? Yeah, you got to feed all the animals.
No, no. That doesn't happen until after.
That's what happened to the unicorn.
You know, you got to clean up after him, and you got to feed him, and you got to give him something to do. You know,
that's a full-time job with as many animals.
Yeah.
A window.
But it's interesting too. You come to verse 15. Then God spoke to Noah. Right? He waited until God spoke. Right? He waited until he had direction from God. And you know, it would have been easy to get impatient. It's like, dry enough. Right? Let's get my galoshes on. Dry enough. I'm getting out of this boat. Talk about cabin fever, you know? But, you know, he waited. He waited until God spoke and told him, you know, okay, go out of the ark. You and your sons, your wife and your sons and your sons' wives with you, bring out with you every living thing of all flesh that is with you, birds and animals and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, that they may breed abundantly on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth. Right, so that brings us right back to Adam and Eve, and that's kind of one of these references that causes us to see that, oh, this is a new, fresh start. A new, fresh start with creation. God's plan was on the brink of extinction, but he preserved the seed, right? We saw that same word. God preserved the seed. He kept his plan intact. He preserved the seed of the woman, and he's going to start over fresh. You know, that's kind of how you start off here. And once again, just hope. God's going to bring about his plan. He gives them a new commission. And so as you come through here, so Noah went out and his sons' wives with him. Every beast, every creeping thing, and every bird that moves on the earth went out by their families from the ark. And so they exit the ark. And then, verse 20, then Noah built an altar to Yahweh and took of every clean animal and every clean bird and offered whole burnt offerings on the altar. Then Yahweh smelled the smoothing aroma, and Yahweh said to himself, I will never again curse the ground on account of man, for the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth, and I will never again destroy everything, every living thing as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest and cold and heat and summer and winter and day and night shall not cease. Just a great picture right here, right? Noah finally gets through the flood, and so he offers a sacrifice to God. Just thankfulness, it's worship to God. He takes these animals and he sacrifices them just in act of worship and act of thanksgiving. Just a reminder, you know, that's what life is. It's worship to God. And so certainly after this great salvation, Noah responds appropriately. He responds just with the thankfulness of his heart for all that God had done on his behalf. And just the great statement that God responds to that offering. God responds to that sacrifice. And in one sense, because of it, says, you know, he smelled the soothing aroma. And he said, you know, I'll never again curse the ground. Just a great statement, just that God is going to... It's just even interesting there, because of the wickedness of man, God says, I will never wipe them out. It's just I would say it's really a statement of God's patience. He understands the wickedness of man. He understands that he understands that Genesis 3 happened, that there was the fall and that everyone's born dead and born sinful. And so, because of that, God is just going to be patient with mankind. Not to say that he wasn't patient even in the days of Noah, but there is just that patience of not wiping. It's a reminder that in one sense, we deserve to all be wiped out like this. You know, as mankind. I mean, not as believers, not as the church here, but speaking from the perspective as we as humans, we deserve this. It's only God's grace and his faithfulness and his patience that, you know, as we see here, that he has committed himself not to do it. And so it's a reminder of God's faithfulness, his patience, and just in response to Noah's worship.
Josh, what's the connection between God cursing the ground in Genesis 3 and him saying he will not curse the ground here?
It's a slightly, if I remember correctly, it's not the same word for curse. But I don't know how strong, but there is definitely, you know, that connection there. I mean, I didn't think that specifically about it, other than to say, I mean, it ties back to original creation once again. And just the wickedness of that, that's the result of the fall, is what's, you know, ends up in the ground being cursed in a sense. And even just the destruction of mankind that ties in with that. So I don't know what I'd say other than, yes, there is a tie. You know, and certainly it ties this narrative together and reminds us of parts earlier. And just that, I guess in a sense you just say that there's effects on the land from the human sin. You know, our sin, we talked about that, you know, in Genesis 3, right? Our sin affects things, affects the land. The land is cursed as a result.
Yeah. So this is interesting, at least because the intent of man's heart to be with you, that comes right after.
Yeah.
And God says, well, I'm not going to curse the ground because there's the understanding that man's wicked. So I'm not going to destroy everything. And then he, you know, says that things will always be the same. They will never cease. I'm just wondering how those tie. I guess I'll have to look at it more.
Well, I mean, the verse 22 has to do with, you know, God interrupted, if you will, the cycles. God interrupted, you know, the normal, you know, with this cataclysmic overturning, hit the reset button on the earth, right? It's like, okay, that's an interruption. It disrupted everything. And God says, no, I'm not going to do that. And that doesn't mean that God's not going to judge sin. Doesn't mean that God's, but he's not going to completely upset the whole world like that again. That just his covenant to not do that. And obviously one day he will do that in a different way. But just God, this is a commitment of God just for patience until that final day. And so as we come to chapter 9, need to keep moving here. God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Once again, just a reminder of the commission to Adam. The fear of you and the terror of you will be on every beast of the earth and every bird of the sky and everything that creeps on the ground and all the fish of the sea. Into your hand they are giving. Every moving thing that is alive shall be food for you. I give all to you as I gave the green plant. Only you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. Surely I will require your lifeblood, and from every beast I will require it, and from every man, from every man's brother, I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made him. As for you, be fruitful and multiply, populate the earth abundantly and multiply in it. Okay, now, this section, I think, and I really appreciate what one of the commentators was saying, is just that the emphasis here is God, remember what happened. God just wiped out all of life on the earth. Right? Just completely wiped it out. And so, you know, God here is making some provisions. The most important thing, I mean, as you read that little section there, the emphasis is on life, whether it be animal life or human life. And the emphasis is really on that human life has value. Even though God just wiped out human life, it doesn't mean that human life isn't valuable to God. And so that's why, you know, it goes back to in the image of God, he created man. You know, there might be this temptation that, you know, as sinners, you know, started populating the earth again, well, God, you know, human life is nothing, right? God just wiped everyone out. So human life has no value whatsoever. And so there's this reminder that no, there is value in human life. And so that's why there's this provision made that, you know, most people would call this the first, you know, institute of human government, right? That if you kill a man, your blood's going to be required from you from man. And there's this, in a sense, almost a law kind of restraining the wickedness of man. Because before the flood, the wickedness of man just ran rampant, right? It was just unrestrained, just as their wickedness just went, ran like rampant in the earth. And so now God is saying, no, human life is valuable, and I'm going to put some restraints on it. And even just the, you know, the provision, God kind of, you know, he had given them all the green plants as food, but now he's giving them the animals as well as food for food. But just this emphasis, you know, but don't eat the flesh with its life, that is its blood, right? Just the importance of life in a sense. And I mean, obviously there's not like a direct connection there, but it's just to show the continual emphasis on life. And so it's a good balance after you just got out of a worldwide cataclysmic destruction of all life to come out of this and remember, okay, but just because of that, that doesn't mean that life is trivial and that life has no value. And so I would see that as being the flow as it connects in with just this cataclysmic flood. And so, then God spoke to Noah and to his sons with him, saying, "Now behold, I myself do establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the cattle, and every beast of the earth with you, of all that comes out of the ark, even every beast of the earth. I establish my covenant with you, and all flesh shall never again be cut off by the water of the flood, neither shall the earth shall there again be a flood to destroy the earth." God said, "This is the sign of the covenant which I am making between me and between you and every living creature that is with you for all successive generations. I set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and you. And it shall come about when I bring a cloud over the earth that the bow will be seen in the cloud, and I will remember my covenant which is between me and every living creature and you and every living creature of all flesh, and never again shall the water become a flood to destroy all flesh. When the bow is in the cloud, then I will look upon it to remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth." And God said to Noah, "This is the sign of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth." So certainly you come to this section, you can't miss the emphasis, right, on covenant. And as we've seen, we already dealt with covenant as you entered into the flood, and even that key word remember that comes in here as well, right? God will be faithful to keep his word. God is a covenant-keeping God. He's a faithful God. He's not going to break his word, right? And so we can, once again, just the application there, we could trust his word. We could believe his word. And there's just a continual reminder of his word with the bow in the clouds. And even that, maybe some of you have heard this already, but that bow in the clouds, it's the same word for bow and arrow. It's like God the warrior that just conquered the earth, right? That, remember in the flood narrative, the God overpowered the earth with his, you know, that word that's the same word as warrior. He took his bow and he set it in the clouds, right? He's like, just a reminder, I'm putting my bow aside, right? I conquered you and now you could see it there. And so, we think of rainbow, we think of, oh, pretty rainbow. And, you know, it's kind of like you said, but it's like, it's a picture of God's destruction. It's a reminder of God's destruction, that his bow's in the clouds, and, you know, and that he's not again going to do that. And so just once again, a reminder of God's faithfulness. Every time we see a rainbow, we should be reminded God has kept his promise. God has been faithful to his word. And that's what the Israelites would have been continually. They see that bow, it's like, oh, yeah. God is faithful. He did what he said. He's a covenant-keeping God. And so therefore, what should we do? We should trust. We should believe. We should wait. We should obey. Right? Because God will do what he said. We can believe and trust in him. And so just a great section here. He's never going to do it again. He's made this covenant. All right? Any questions there? Yeah.
How do we know that it never rained?
Well, it's not a question that, before?
Yeah.
You go back to Genesis chapter 2, and it talks about how the mist came up to water the land. That would be the...
God had not caused it to...
That's right. Yes. Thank you.
Because, this would be after it rained, then you'd see the bow.
Right.
It's interesting he says the same word for a warrior's bow, or is it the same word for warrior?
Bow.
Bow and arrow. Yeah. But then also in the flood narrative where we said eight times it has that word overpower, that's the word for basic. It's the same root as the noun warrior. Like a gibor is a warrior, and this is the root gavar, you know, to overpower.
It's just interesting that God's like putting his bow on the shelf.
Yeah.
But he's putting his bow on the shelf. He's not putting like a smiley face on the shelf.
Right.
Bow up there.
Right.
Use, but he's not using it.
Right.
There instead.
Exactly. Just as a reminder, right? And so, I mean, once again, just the emphasis for us to remember God's faithfulness. God keeps his word. God does what he says, right? He keeps his side of the bargain, and he calls us to do it as well.
I think this is the first time I've looked at the flood in a way that, because we always look at it as like God's, you know, justice and wrath, but merciful, not just that he saved Noah, but the reason why he saved Noah to protect his line for Christ, and that whole circle of events and how it was a benefit for man that the flood happened to begin with. You know what I mean? Even though the circumstances had to be so incredible, it's just amazing, just the whole plan and how it can be looked at as like a benefit for man as well as, I mean, obviously not for sinful man, but, and not just the, for us in general that we're talking right now. You know what I mean? That's just amazing. So.
That's good perspective. Good. Yeah, so as we just kind of reflect on that flood, it is just God's salvation. That's what the flood really is. It's God's salvation through the ark, and just because Noah walked with God, he was faithful. I forgot to mention a couple times through there at key points, especially in chapter 8, that the key word rest came in, like the ark rested on the mountain. And that, just remember how way back Noah's father named him Noah because he will bring rest to the earth. Remember that way back in, not way back, what's that? 529, right? Then he called his name Noah, saying this one will give us rest from our work. And so then three times, at least, that I counted, the root based on rest is in here. Just a reminder that in one sense, God did use Noah to bring rest. God used him in a great way to bring about his plan. So it's a good reminder as well. All right, so we finish with the last section here. And this is... obviously an interesting little story that comes in, but verse 18. Now the sons of Noah who came out of the ark were Shem and Ham and Japheth. And Ham was the father of Canaan. These three were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole earth was populated. Okay, now let me just stop there for a second. In Hebrew narrative, they often do this where they kind of give some background statement. And he does this in, you know, and Ham was the father of Canaan. This is a piece of background information. It's very typical in Hebrew style to put up front, you're going to tell a story, right? But you put some piece of vital information up front so that when you get to the relevant part of the story, you'll keep that in your mind. And so that's a very significant statement. You know, now Ham was the father of Canaan. It's like background information. I want you to know this because it's going to be important for the story that follows. That's kind of a part of Hebrew narrative that they do that. It happens all over the place, but another time it talks about in Ruth chapter 2, I think verse 1, talks about now, I don't even remember exactly what it says, but it talks about how Naomi had a relative, a close relative, and his name was Boaz. It's like the narrator is giving you this background information. Then you read along, what do you know? Boaz shows up. Right? And so it's like, okay, here's this background information. Keep that in mind because it's going to be relevant to the story. And so, anyway, you'll see how it plays in. And so these three were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole earth was populated, right? So once again, a reminder, God saved this family, and everybody came from them. Nobody else was left. And so then Noah began farming and planted a vineyard. And even there, he began being a man of the land, and possibly even kind of tying him back to Adam. You know, Adam was a man of the ground. That's what Adam means, right? Dirt, basically. And so here you have Noah being a man of the land. And he planted a vineyard, and he drank of the wine and became drunk, and uncovered himself inside his tent. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his fathers and told his two brothers outside. And so, it's just interesting as you come to this point, right? Here's Noah, this righteous man, godly man, obedient man, man of faith, man of trusting, man of righteousness, blameless in his generation. And he comes out of the ark, you know, new creation. We're starting over, fresh beginnings. First thing that happens, he gets drunk and he's naked. And I mean, obviously this is not good, you know, and obviously it ties right back to, I mean, it should just trigger in your mind, Adam and Eve naked, right? Just the shame of nakedness. And it just should immediately trigger you. Oh, this is shameful. Oh, this is the same thing that happened to Adam and Eve. And so even though God had started a new beginning, even though he preserved his line, he preserved his seed, you know, it's not perfect, right? We're fallen humanity. The effects of the fall still got through the boat, if you will, right? They brought the sin nature. They brought their death with them. And so the first act, man, sin right there, you know? And so it's just a reminder that, you know, God's plan is still going to prevail, even in spite of sin. And we see, you know, Tower of Babel, right? We'll see that next. The whole earth, you know, assembles against God and his plan, you know, but God, you know, works through it again. And God keeps working, right? His nation gets taken to Egypt, but what does he do? He brings them out. And, you know, the nation of Israel sins, right? But so he exiles them to Babylon, but he brings them back. And just over and over again, you know, there's like this climax of, you know, God does something new, and then people fail. God does something new, and people fail, but God's plan just keeps prevailing. God's plan just keeps going on. So there's this continual hope that God is going to accomplish his purpose. I mean, he's going to eventually change people's hearts, and it's ultimately going to happen as people are obedient to him. And so anyway, we just keep seeing this, that there's that need for obedience if God is going to accomplish his purpose. And so once again, we see the link between Noah and Adam. There's been a lot of those ties. So Ham saw the father's nakedness, the nakedness of his father, and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it upon both of their shoulders and walked backwards and covered the nakedness of their father, and their faces were turned away so that they did not see their father's nakedness. Okay, there's a strong contrast here. You know, what? It's not like, oh, Ham just accidentally did this. Right? There's a contrast being developed between what Ham did and what Shem and Japheth did. Like, and when it says he saw it, it's probably, you could almost say gazed or something like that. And then even just the fact that he didn't do anything about it, like his two brothers, he went and told his brothers, you know, you could kind of read between the lines, and it probably wasn't, you know, hey, we need to go do something about this, and just out of concern for his father. You know, it just, there's this strong contrast, even how, but Shem and Japheth, you know, this, even in the grammar there of 23, if I'm not mistaken there, just contrast them. And so they went in backwards, and just the very careful, you know, they were so careful. And, you know, as it records in verse 23 what they did, it's like they went backwards. They had this whole plan of how to do it without seeing the nakedness of their father. And it's just a reminder even here, and you think about it, it's kind of a weird story, but nakedness just pictures shame and guilt. Right, we saw that all the way back in chapter 3. We see it again here. And in one sense, the picture is Ham is reveling in shame and guilt, whereas Shem and Japheth are trying to cover it. Right? God covers Adam and Eve's guilt and their shame. But Ham is just like talking about it and not trying to cover it. He's trying to expose it in a sense. And so there's this contrast between how do they deal with sin and guilt. And obviously there's repercussions from this. And so in verse 24, when Noah woke from his wine, he knew what his youngest son had done to him. So he said, "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants he shall be to his brothers." He also said, "Blessed be Yahweh, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant." Noah lived and 50 years after the flood. So all the days of Noah were 950 years and he died. So you come to the end of this and you have this oracle here where God, cursed be Canaan, but blessed be the God of Shem. So once again, our key theme, right? Blessing and cursing. There's blessing for obedience. There's cursing for disobedience. There's blessing for dealing with sin in a right way. There's cursing for reveling in shame and sinfulness, right? And even there, there's, once again, there's two paths, right? There's two lines. You can either follow the one or follow the other. And so here it says, cursed be Canaan. And probably most of you are like, wait a minute, didn't Ham do this? But what was that important piece of background information that we all needed to keep in the back of our minds? That Canaan was the son? And so, you know, I don't want to get into a big ordeal about, well, why did God do that? Why did God curse his son instead of him? I would say, okay, you hear Canaan, what comes to your mind when you hear Canaan? Canaanites, the land of Canaan, right? And what were the Canaanites known for? Wickedness. I mean, that's why God wanted to wipe them out from the land. And what is the setting of this book? Going into the promised land to kill all the Canaanites, right? And so certainly this is an important piece of information for them as it ties to their setting, right? That, okay, these Canaanites, this is why. It's their wickedness. And you could ask, you know, does the chicken come before the egg kind of a question? Was it because God cursed them that they were wicked, or they're wicked because they're cursed? And I don't want to get into all the details of that, but you just see that, you know, they were cursed because of their father's wickedness, and they were wicked as well. There's a correlation there. And I don't want to, like I said, you could go drive yourself crazy trying to figure out all the connections there in one sense, just theologically. You know, how could God curse his son when the father did it? But I think it's just to say that the son had the same characteristics as his father. You know, he had the same, you know, that's why he got cursed. And the Canaanites had the same. And it's even interesting, you look at the other descendants of Ham, the Egyptians, the Babylonians, here are the Canaanites. These are all descendants of Ham, right? These wicked peoples opposed to God and his plan and his purpose all throughout their history. The Assyrians. And so, obviously, as we get to the Table of Nations in chapter 10 and following, we're going to see these different people groups and how they originated from these three sons and how it all relates back to God's global plan and his purpose. But the overriding point is here is there's blessing for acting righteously. There's blessing for having your sin covered and not for exposing sin. And so certainly as the Israelites would have read this, they would have understand the implications for the Canaanites. And just once again, the Canaanites were known for the worst kind of debaucherous, sinful living. And so were the Egyptians and the Babylonians and the Assyrians even.
It's interesting how God often emphasizes his judgment on wickedness in terms of sexual sin. Like, he emphasizes you hoard yourself as a nation, uses sexual metaphors, and then he says, like, specifically, your people were actually sexually immoral. And then the nakedness here, it's interesting that, like, the reason that it's so shameful, that kind of sin, is because it's glorifying shame. Because nakedness is a picture, outside of marriage, of sin. And the origination of sin. So, like, it seems to implicate the shamefulness of nakedness and people glorifying that shame makes it that much more shameful, you know. And so that's why, like, judgment often comes when it gets to that point. People start to glory in that kind of shame.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Ham gloried in shame.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's a good summary. Ham gloried in shame rather than Shem and Japheth trying to cover it, right? Trying to hide the shame, in a sense. Trying to deal with the shame. And even that word cover, if I'm not mistaken, yeah, it is. I'm almost positive that's the same word that is like the word for atone. You know, that sin is covered. I have to double check, but I'm pretty sure about that. And so it's just, you know, they were covering sin. It's a picture of atonement as opposed to dealing with sin and not just exposing and just glorying in shame. So I like the way that you put that there.
What do you say? The word cover here is the word for atonement, or just the word atonement is the word for comfort.
Well,
sure. That's what the word means.
Right.
Yes. So what other word would you use?
Well, I'd have to look at the verb tense, though, because atonement may be just a specific tense. Anyway, I don't want to get into the details of it, but it's the same idea.
Hey, Josh.
Yeah.
Question. Verse 25, like the cursing?
Yes.
I couldn't tell if God is cursing, saying the cursing, or is it Noah who's saying the cursing?
No, Noah.
So if Noah is saying the cursing, is there a different relevance in how we... I deem that because Noah's making some sort of judgment versus God cursing?
Yeah, that's a great comment, and the commentators deal with that. I mean, certainly just in general speaking, like, I could curse you, right? I mean, we even use that, you know, curse you out kind of thing. And certainly that happens even in the Bible, right, where someone will curse someone else. But it becomes relevant when, and I didn't remember the exact words that some of the commentators were using, but when you are, in one sense, saying the same thing that God's saying, there's kind of like a, if I curse you and God's not behind it, sure, it doesn't mean anything. But in this context here, although it doesn't explicitly say it, it seems to be that this is kind of a righteous judgment that Noah's making because of their sin and such. And so in one sense, God's behind, and I'm not saying it maybe as articulately as the commentators were talking about it, but ultimately the cursing derives its power from God, obviously, and not from Noah. And it's because Noah is saying, he's, if you will, standing in God's will when he pronounces this curse that has any ongoing effects and power. So same thing with the blessing, right? I mean, it only has any of God's the only one that's ultimately able to bless and curse. And so it's not really related in a sense, but it's kind of like church discipline where, you know, God says when two or three of you are gathered in my name, you make this pronouncement, but God in heaven is making the same pronouncement because you're doing it in accordance with his will and his word. And so it derives, in one sense, its power from that. It's kind of the same idea with blessing and cursing. Because obviously, you know, Shimei, you know, is curses David, you know, and all this stuff. Does that mean David was cursed? No, because Shimei was not, you know, in line with God's plan and his purpose and such.
We got to talk about this a lot more when we get into the... those narratives, because like all the people who like cursed Saul, and like they like took their heads and of all his offspring.
Yeah,
that's kind of crazy.
Yeah, there's a lot of.
With my current understanding, it's kind
of
crazy.
Yeah, there's a lot of blessing and cursing, but basically this is valid because Noah was, in one sense, in God's will, in line with God's perspective as he gives this blessing and cursing, and that's just obvious as the narrative flows here, I guess I would say. Just from the context, that seems clear.
Seems like that with all the patriarchal fathers throughout the narrative of Genesis. Is that kind of true? Like when, I don't know, like they always, like the birthright, does it have anything to do with that? Like, or they, yeah. You know, bless the one line and curse the other line kind of thing?
Sure.
Is it kind of the similar type?
Yeah, very similar. Very similar, yeah.
They're part of God's line that those fathers kind of pass on.
Sure, absolutely. They pass on the blessing. We'll see that as Genesis unfolds.
By the line, I guess, that blessing is going to be upon.
Right, and it often, if I could put it this way, it's in faith that the patriarchs do bless, whether it be the younger or whatever son, they do end up blessing versus cursing and such. But because they're doing it from faith, they're doing it in line with God's will and his purpose. In one sense, God authenticates it. I don't know exactly how you'd say it. But certainly it's a human blessing, but when it's done from the right perspective, when you're doing it in line with God's will, then it becomes effectual, it becomes effective. So we could talk more about that.
It even protects from wrong blessings like Balaam.
Exactly.
In reading 2 Peter, and it compares the false prophets to Balaam and following his error.
Right. He's, you know, he tries to curse God's people, but God won't let him curse, you know, because God's ultimately the one that's got to, you know, is the one that has to bless or curse. So yeah, that's an important narrative in the unfolding of the Pentateuch as well. And so we end, and Noah dies. And it just, I mean, it's kind of a succinct statement, but it's just a reminder, right? The effects of the false, I mean, even this righteous man, he still sinned. But God's plan didn't end with him, right? And so just a great reminder for all of us just to keep trusting in God, God will be faithful to his plan. We'll continue to watch it unfold throughout the book of Genesis. All right, let me close us in prayer. Our Father, we do just thank you so much, ultimately for your great salvation, as we read about your salvation of Noah in the ark. Just a great reminder to us. Even just every rainbow we see, Lord, should remind us that you poured out your wrath and destroyed the earth and conquered and prevailed and overpowered it. And yet you are faithful. You are faithful to your word. You are faithful to those who walk humbly before you, just in righteousness, trusting in you, faithful, obedient, just careful to do what you say. So we just thank you for that. We thank you that you are continuing to bring about your plan. You will judge the world in righteousness, we know, once again, but there is your plan of salvation in the midst of it through the seed of the woman, which you preserved. So we just thank you for your grace. We thank you for these reminders. We pray that you'd help us to trust in your faithfulness as we walk with you as well. Pray these things in Christ's name. Amen.